106.6.
Great radio for the community, from the community.
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Broadcasting live from the heart of North Manchester.
106.6.
Vamos a casa de Nina, vamos a casa de Nina, que ella da un tango. Para el chango son los cueros, hay que ponerle carnero y harina con quimbombo. Pompo se estará bailando y una santera cantándole.
Hello everybody, that was Nina from Joe Cuba Quartet. I'm Rina Yedu and it's Sanguine, which is now on every other week. So it's not the end of the month, but we're on. We're your best urban source for all science and tech news and opinion. Today, we're sharing slightly more skin by interviewing Professor Michelle Destrade, who gave a seminar at Manchester University yesterday. Thanks so much for speaking with us today, Michelle, and a warm welcome to Manchester. Please tell us briefly about what your seminar was on.
Oh, hi. Thank you. The seminar was about how to apply the tools of mathematics, mechanical engineering, and computer science to the study of soft tissues in our body. Okay. So in particular, I was explaining how can we determine which is softer, the brain or jelly, or also I explained which is the best way to cut open a body. So it was really fun stuff.
Yeah. So when you say jelly, do you mean sort of a trifle jelly?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I thought of that because that's the softest thing I can think of in the real world.
Yes, and maybe baby food, but that's quite difficult.
Yeah. To use. Maybe yogurt or soft cheese.
Yeah.
I thought jelly would be give you a good idea because you know that if you just shake it a little bit, it starts moving
widely. And
it's wobbly
and everything, so it's probably the perfect thing. So Michelle is actually from NUI Galway in Ireland, but he doesn't sound originally from Ireland. So tell us something nice in French and a bit of your background as well as what led you to NUI Galway.
Okay. Merci pour cette invitation. Je suis très heureux de pouvoir parler sur une radio à Manchester.
Oh, wow. I think I got thank you in Manchester. That's
okay. And then... as we got to my background, I was educated in physics in France, and then I followed that by a blend of applied mathematics, engineering, and theoretical physics in Ireland.
I was going to go straight in with how would we get from physics to sort of skin, but no, I'm not going to go off track. So your research and seminar has been around modeling and studying biological soft tissues.
That's right.
Okay, so we always try as part of Sanguine to get a better understanding of terms used in research. So one of the articles I've read around you says, skin is a highly nonlinear, anisotropic, viscoelastic, and nearly incomprehensible material. I had to really enunciate there. Why is skin so incomprehensible, and what is anisotropic?
I guess it's in my field, right? If I was, for instance, professor of anatomy, I could talk about the constituents of skins and I could use a different jargon that only anatomists will understand. These are words that are used a lot in engineering, in materials engineering. And it's not incomprehensible, it's incompressible.
Incompressible!
Right?
Yeah. I actually copied and pasted it and it does say incompressible and I've put in incomprehensible. I think that was
it's true that the words are incomprehensible if you don't study the field. Yes. It's a problem in science that we have to use very specific words that are not that well known outside the field. Mm. In any case, anisotropic, it refers to the fact that the skin is quite soft, has a quite soft matrix, but inside it there's fibers, collagen fibers that are stiffer, that are embedded in the skin. So those fibers, collagen fibers, you can see them, for instance, in a piece of meat, of a beef steak, for instance, you will see fibers with your naked eye, and you know that it's easier to cut parallel to the fibers than perpendicular to the fibers. And the more fibers there are, the tougher the meat is, unless you cook it for a long time, in which case the collagen starts melting and you can just pull the meat apart. So that's what anisotropic refers to, the stiffness of those fibers that are embedded in the skin.
And that's what makes it so incompressible.
So it makes it very stiff in some directions. It makes it very hard to deform in some directions. Skin is a very, very resistant material.
You're more of a dictionary today as well. But we love our we love our technical terms, so we try to make them more huggable. And another phrase I saw was, biomedical engineers often see tissues as engineering materials and try to evaluate their mechanical properties. So they use things like tensile testing, simple shear, torsion. In workaday language, what do those terms actually stand for?
Yes, so they refer to testing protocols. So just like in engineering, if you want to build a structure, for instance, you want to find out which type of steel or of concrete you're going to use that would be able to withstand load or maybe movement from the wind and so on and so forth. So you need to know how strong a given material is. And what you do, you go in the workshop and you just test them using protocols that have been now accepted widely by the community. So tensile testing just means pulling on a piece of material, figuring out how much force it takes to deform it. Simple shear means sliding the material one direction with respect to another. And then torsion means twisting it, figuring out how much force, how much torque you have to exert to deform it in a twisting motion.
And so in relation to those things, are its skin quite well, I would think it's easy to tear as in tearing it.
Yeah, it's much easier to deform than steel, of course.
Yes, well, you'd hope, wouldn't you?
Yes, but so we had to figure out how much, by which factor is it easier, or is it softer than steel or wood or all those hard materials that are being tested by engineers. We just apply the same protocols but to skin or to other organs in the body and find out now values for those materials. So of engineering approach to the body.
Thank you for that. I hope we haven't been too exhibitionist with all our skin sharing with Professor Michelle. While our listeners decide on that, we're going to go with Yellow with Oh Yeah. Back with Professor Michelle Destrade talking all about skin. In practical terms for surgeons and others trying to get into the body, the question you're trying to answer is, what's the best way of opening up the body? Have you found the answer, and what is it?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, so you have found the answer.
Well, the answer is known by surgeons, of course, because when they open you up, they want to make sure that you're going to have a neat scar once they have stitched you back up, that the scar is going to heal as quickly and as neatly as possible. And so if they approach a site, say for instance they want to remove a mole on your face, they want to know where should they cut, this way or that way. And so they look in anatomy books, and there they will find maps of the body that tell them in which direction the skin is stretched. Yeah, because I forgot to mention that skin is stretched in our body. It's under tension and it's stretched in different directions at different locations. And it's very important to know what those directions are.
Okay.
Because the reason is, if you cut perpendicular to those lines, so just imagine your body, say, covered in zebra lines. And if you cut perpendicular to those lines, the skin is it's stretched along those lines, so the wound is going to gape open if you cut perpendicular to that. And then I can stitch you back up, but there will still be a tug at that site that will require nutrients to be brought to the site for it to heal, and they will lead to a colored and bumpy and unsightly scar. Whereas if I was cutting parallel to the lines, then the tension will just shut the cut together, and it will lead to a very neat scar. So you could see now when surgeons, for instance, are planning an appendectomy to remove your appendix, they're going to cut you in a sort of a horizontal way. They're not going to cut you vertically.
Yeah.
They won't cut you horizontal, and that will lead to a neat scar. And if they were cutting vertically, you'll have an ugly brown scar that will take a lot will be really unsightly. So they pay a lot of attention to this. But like I say in the books, they only have a map for men and a map for women. They don't have a map for a given person at a given time.
Right.
And we argue that those lines, they change, they vary slightly from one person to another according to your age, your corpulence, you know, your weight, or say your health status, your ethnicity, or maybe if you've been burnt or exposed to sun, all of this will have an effect on your skin. And so we were looking at trying to find a way to find the best direction to perform a cut at a given spot on a given person. And we hope we are making good progress in that direction.
I was just going to ask, when you talked about the skin is stretched.
Yes.
And just on more practical, maybe a little bit gruesome as well, too. you know, when...
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. It is
no,
gruesome.
No, no, no. We do gruesome.
Maybe some auditors should look the other way.
Yes. When it's stretched, you know, when you have stretch marks and things like that, and it can never go, it never seems to be able to go back. As in, you know, mm-hmm. if you put on weight and sometimes a bit gruesome,
yes.
but people have to sort of cut the extra skin because...
That's true.
It never. So is that right? As in, once it's stretched, it just never...
So skin is very elastic, right? If you were, for instance, pulling on the lobe of your ear, you could just stretch it a lot.
Mm.
And if you let go, it goes back to its original size. But there's a limit to how much you can be stretched elastically.
Ah.
And that's called the plastic limit. So if you go beyond that, then it's going to deform plastically. That means that if you stop exerting a force on it, it will stay there. Or it will just retract a little bit, but it won't go back to its original shape. And you can see that for people who put darts into their earlobe, and then when they're too big,
they can't,
you know,
can't
that it's not going to go back.
Yeah.
It won't stretch too much. And then stretch marks, yeah, they happen like that. Although there's progress also in that direction. I think there's some oils that can smoothen the stretch marks a bit. Yeah, if you have had a huge weight loss, then you might be stuck with
where your skin was before.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it has adapted to that, and it won't come back beyond the elastic limit.
That's right. It's plastic surgeon time, isn't it, really? So since we've gone down the nice route, as in your surgeon is trying to get the best wound healing,
mm-hmm.
too much law and order on my part of CSI, but is there like the worst way to open you up, as in if you were stabbed or slashed a la the murderer in Scream? Is there like... the worst way that you could possibly...
Yes, usually the worst scars happen from accidents or from assault, stabbing incidents, where the people with the skin would be cut perpendicular to those lines.
Is it one big slash that's a problem, or, you know, little, I don't know, nick?
Say, for instance, you had a small cut on your thorax when you were young, and it was perpendicular to those lines of stretching. Then it will give an unsightly small scar. But as you grow, the scar will just keep growing and growing and expand over your whole thorax.
Yeah.
That can happen.
Wow.
And that's really unlucky. Now, if you're an adult, it could be that you're being cut perpendicular to the lines again, and then it will look like a colored, bumpy, unsightly scar. And there's nothing much you can do about that.
Are they sort of... other interventions you're looking at which have stemmed from your research?
Eventually, yes. We want to be able to provide the surgeons with a small, reliable and accurate device that will tell them which way to cut a given person at a given spot. That's what I want to do. So in this process, maybe in 2-3 years from now, we'll be able to do that.
Okay, and are we talking about, you know, those 3D images that kind of go over this, where the surgeon puts on the thing and he can see where to cut, or is it going to be another method that will be used?
I think it'd be very simple. Yeah, it's just a sort of a probe, like the size maybe of a big marker that you put on your skin, and it sends sound waves, and tells you, oh well, this is the direction where the wave is going as fast, so this is the direction where it should go. So maybe we'll have like a, I don't know, a laser beam telling you which direction to cut, something like that.
So it's going to be very simple and done.
Yes.
As the surgeon is going in just to get the.
Yes.
Oh, excellent. Wow. And, you know, no going in and trying things out, sort of just from the top. yeah. And I think it's not going to be painful, as in it's just going to be.
No, the probe itself is not painful at all. No. Of course, all the testing before would be painful, but we'll do it on animals.
Okay, yeah.
Probably on cadavers or things, something like that.
Okay.
We'll just want trials to figure out if that's correct, if our intuition is correct.
You also do research around the brain with researchers from Tsinghua University?
Beijing, yes.
So tell us a little bit about that. Were you actually trying to find out whether it was softer than jelly?
Yeah, well, that's the way I like to present it, because it's a catchy way of summarizing it.
I know, yeah. I keep thinking of red jelly now every time you say that.
Which is softer, brain or jelly? And
yes.
In the end, we found out that brain was actually much softer than jelly.
Wow.
Which
really?
Is
amazing.
Is scary.
Yeah.
I know. But the other reason we were, so it was fun to find out, but the other reason is because we wanted to test the brain and find those parameters I was mentioning earlier for through testing. And so that way we'll have a better idea of how the brain deforms following, say, an impact or a trauma.
So you mean the tensile testing, the shearing, and
yes. So all those tests, we cannot perform them on the brain because it's so soft.
Yeah.
So we had to use a different route. What we used was sound waves. We just launched sound waves through the brain of a pig, and we watched the sound wave travel using a medical imaging, and we measured speed. And from that measurement, we could tell how soft or hard the brain is, just like from, say, measuring the frequency of a vibrating guitar string, you can tell if it's stout or slack. The same principle.
And does that have anything to do with how it's reflected back as well, or were you just looking at the speed it was traveling through?
Yeah, just the speed it was traveling to tell us how soft it was. And now we have a good idea how soft it is, and then we can feed that into a computer code to maybe try to recreate images of what happens in the brain during a given event.
And maybe, is everybody's brain different, or are they roughly quite similar?
They're roughly similar, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Whether you're male,
from a mechanical from a mechanical point of view, of course. From a cognitive point of view, it's a different problem.
Definitely.
Yes. But from a mechanical point of view, they're more or less as soft. And then that's why we are so susceptible to concussion events or traumatic brain injuries, because the brain can deform a lot when the skull is shaken or hit. And then if it stretches too much, a bit like I was telling you earlier about the skin, if it stretches too much, then some neurons can get damaged or broken, and then you have what's called axonal injury. You could have an impairing of your brain function after that. So it's very important to determine how much you can stretch it before this occurs.
And it occurs to me that a lot of people do extreme sports, athletes traveling at incredible speeds. Is the skull, you know, just, you know, the mightiest helmet in the world, or really there should be more injuries, but we just don't know why we're being protected so much?
Well, the brain is well protected by first there's a very tough membrane covering it. It's called the dura mater, and then there's the skull, which is extremely resistant to shocks. But I guess evolution hasn't caught up with modern life, right? Maybe if you think of our Paleolithic ancestors, they had to deal with occasional blows to the head, maybe from falling or bumping into something from accidents, but maybe they would have had a couple of dozen accidents like that in their life. But in modern life now, we're traveling at huge speed in the car, and then if we crash into a wall, the acceleration is going to be enormous, and evolution hasn't prepared the brain for this type of accelerations. Or if you talk about sports, there are some sports that encourage repeated blows to the brain, to the skull.
Like boxing.
Like boxing or martial arts or American football, for instance, or soccer also, where people practice headers all the time. And then rugby, but that's less frequent because that's an accident when you hit your head. Mm. But in American football, for instance, they have to go and enter into the opponent with the head first.
Mm.
And so evolution hasn't prepared the brain to deal with repeated knocks like this, repeated blows. And that leads to concussion and maybe later to impair the cognitive function in later life. There's a lot of activity in this area now. There's even a movie last month with Will Smith called Concussion.
That's right. I remember
that.
I don't think it's come out yet, but yes, I remember them saying.
It seems very boring. I only saw the trailer.
Oh, right. Okay.
It didn't seem exciting, but at least it brought the word concussion in the mainstream.
Yeah.
So
he needed to make it all men in black, didn't he? Rather than
true.
Really sincere. Yeah. So from your research, what different or innovative routes would you look into researching to even better protect ourselves? I mean, I know American football, they wear those really tough helmets.
But that's actually a problem because they have the helmet, they actually hit even harder and they think they are protected, but they go for it even harder and then it's bad for the brain.
Mm.
It protects the skull, but not the brain from those accelerations.
Right.
So helmets can be a problem. But really, I guess to better protect ourselves, we should just avoid repeated blows to the head in general.
You would think, wouldn't you?
Yes.
That should be the general aim. Yeah.
True. You shouldn't practice boxing because
that's right.
That's the finality of it is to hit somebody so much repeatedly on the head until they lose consciousness. So an induced concussion.
Mm.
And then also there's a lot of progress to be made in designing better helmets. Yes, it's still not great, the design of helmets.
As in, helmets are quite tough, but would it be better to have like a softer material? So in effect,
probably yes. Probably in rugby, for instance, you can think of a covering that will have, I don't know, a spongy material that will absorb shocks a lot. That would be a better idea, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Rather than a hard shell that will encourage them to hit harder.
So we're now going to have a short music break with the lively Saber Dance and Aram Khachurian. Back with our guest, Professor Michelle Distraud, who has been discussing the mechanics of skin and brain tissue. One of the things you've mentioned previously is that you feel your field has too much specialization. And I've never heard this from architects or plumbers, but you hear this a lot from scientists about there's just too much specialization. And they talk a lot about multidisciplinary teams as well.
Mm-hmm.
Can you expand on the problems caused by too much specialization?
Yeah, well, if you think of an architect, she will have to put together a team of specialists already, right? She has to find plumbers, electricians, insulation specialists, carpenters, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And they would all have to work together towards a common goal. And they would be given a certain budget and deadlines. But at least the architect will have like a good grasp of everybody's specialty, of all aspects of the project. While in science, if you were to put together a team of specialists to work together towards the same goal, it would be very difficult to find somebody who will understand everybody's research. because it's just, it's grown so much, science has grown so much now that it's beyond human capacity to understand every aspect of science. And so you're limited now in the multidisciplinary research. You're limited by this. You cannot grasp every aspect of a given program.
So how is it currently handled? As in, if you do need a multidisciplinary team,
Difficult. First of all, you have to find a person who will have the capability of putting all this thing together, and then you have to find a research agency, which will be able to fund it. And first of all, to review it, that would be difficult too, because there's so many aspects. And then they would be happy to fund a research that seems really a blue sky research, that seems that could maybe lead nowhere, but still will have to recruit so many people. It's very difficult to do multidisciplinary research. It's true.
And now there's another thing that's quite close to my heart that you've actually mentioned. You talked about girls and women in science. So Sangwin, originally when we started, and even our logo is all the things women have invented. So what type of initiatives have you been part of or feel should be more readily available to sort of counteract the perceptions around women in science? And also, how can we encourage them more into science?
The first problem is society's perception of this gender divide, that girls don't like maths or don't like hard science as much as boys. But that's, in my opinion, that's just a cultural thinking of the times. To give you an example, when in the early days of the computer, computers were huge machines that required, you know, electricity and bulbs and nuts and bolts and so on and so forth. And with men who were doing that part, because this was seen as a boy's occupation, while programming the computer, which required typing and maybe perforating cards and so on, this was given to women. It was seen as a girly occupation. And now, if you think back to 50, 60 years later, programming or coding is seen as a boy's occupation only. So you could see how it all depends on a given perception at a given time of a cultural aspect of society. Yeah. So it's really disheartening when people tell you, oh, well, girls are just not good at computers. Not true. Everybody is equally talented at the beginning, and then they are challenged by society's expectation. That's the first problem. The other problem facing women in science is that they could see that further down the food chain, there are mostly men at the post of responsibilities or at the professorial level. If you look at statistics, you will see that now there are, I think, a little bit more women than men entering a third level education. And yet, if you look at professors, for instance, it's less than 20% female. Ireland actually has a very bad record in that aspect. So if you see that, if you start in career in science and you see that you have very little chance of making it to the top, you're probably going to take your chances somewhere else. I think that's also very discouraging. So to counteract all this, we can impose quotas, for instance. I think that could help shift the balance very quickly. And in my own university in Galway, we've had a gender equality commission put in place that actually recommended this. So I'd be interested to see what the university is going to do now. Another thing you could do is encourage girls and women in the school or in the university, just by helping them to take the study of mathematics to the highest level. And I'm always encouraging everybody to do more maths, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And finally, I guess you could target support schemes for women in science at given stages of their career. Maybe there could be a grant for maternity support or things like this, or in fact just grants for aimed at women in science in particular. That would be the avenues I can think of.
I think those are excellent. And I think one of the things I really enjoyed speaking to you today about is And I think there's some research that women actually enjoy the practical applications of things. So rather than just saying, oh, abstract, you know, we're going to measure things, it's why we're measuring it, as in what's the end product as well? What's it ending up as? Not to say that they can't do the abstract as well, but
sure.
Looking at various ways in which people learn as well might be something that's
true. Yeah, it's at every level of the way. And then at the end, yes, at the moment, that personally, I'm a professor, but I know that when I applied for promotion, the playing field wasn't level. There was a bias encouraging me to apply and discouraging women to do it.
Yes, and sometimes it's unknown bias, as in people don't know that what they're
true.
Doing is causing a bias, which is
I'm not saying
harder.
It's not concerted effort to keep women out of position of power. It's just, like I said earlier, it's just a sort of societal, cultural framework
that influences
everybody. Influences girls as well. They say, oh, well, I've never liked math.
That's right. You start to believe it
when
you're young.
Yes. So in the end, everybody is equally talented to do mathematics or whatever they want. That's right. Everybody, statistically, over a large population, there should be an equal proportion of talented and mediocre people at a given field, but independently of their gender.
So before we end today, I'd like to give a big thank you from all listening to Sanguine to Michelle for joining us today. Let's find out from Michelle who he'd like to put into our Hall of Fame, either from the sciences or, you know, personal. Who's going in today, Michelle?
Well, I'm sorry, it's a man.
No, it's fine.
But I would have thought I should promote William Hamilton. He was one of the, he's actually the most celebrated Irish scientist of all time. He was active in the 19th century, and all his inventions and equations and so on have had very important repercussion in mechanics, in optics, in algebra. He's very well known in Ireland and celebrated there. And then his name will be known by physicists or mathematicians. But I'm happy to promote his name.
Say it again.
To the wider public. Hamilton.
William Hamilton.
Yeah, William Hamilton.
Okay, well, into our Hall of Fame goes William Hamilton. Thank you very much for speaking with us, Michelle.
Oh, thank you for